from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. 30 years ago, this Sunday, June the 5th, 1981, a news report about young men suffering from a rare form of pneumonia appeared in Los Angeles. A month later, a report in the New York Times about a rare form of cancer affecting gay men. It would be years before the disease would have a name, AIDS. Coming up on Forum, we look back at the last 30 years of the AIDS story, what life was like in San Francisco during those early years, what's been learned about the disease, and what remains a mystery, the treatment breakthroughs, and the still elusive search for a cure. AIDS in America, Year 30, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The early headlines 30 years ago were mysterious, rare forms of pneumonia and cancer affecting gay men. Over time, the headlines turned deadly as the disease that came to be known as AIDS took its toll. 60 million people worldwide infected, 30 million of whom eventually died. As the AIDS epidemic unfolded, San Francisco was often front and center, both in terms of the devastation the disease wrought and the efforts to turn the tide. 30 years into the AIDS story, some of the stories have now begun to change. SF HIV policy could have huge impact, read one recent headline. Early AIDS treatment slashes transmission rate, read another. So in this hour of Forum, we're going to look back at the past 30 years of the AIDS story and then assess both where we are today and where we need to go from here. Joining us to do that, Dr. Grant Colfax. He's the director of the HIV Prevention and Research Department for the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Dr. Colfax, good morning.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Happy to have you join us. Stephen LeBlanc joins us as well. He is a board member of the AIDS Policy Project, formerly an activist with ACT UP Golden Gate. Stephen LeBlanc, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, too.
Dr. Stephen Deeks joins us, too. He is a professor of medicine at UCSF. Dr. Deeks, good morning.
Good morning.
And Jeff Sheehy joins us as well. He's an HIV patient advocate and a board member of the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine. Jeff, good morning.
Good morning, Dave. Thanks.
Well, let's begin with what life was like, really, 30 years ago when these stories first came out and in those first few years in the 80s as we began to come to terms with this disease that came to be known as AIDS. Jeff Sheehy, take us back to that time, what that time was like, and the sort of fear that invaded so much of this town in particular in those early years.
Well, 30 years ago, I was just coming out. So for me, it was like a bright spring day, right? Mm-hmm. And suddenly, like a tornado hit, using the kind of a metaphor for what's happening nowadays. It just, you know, people, you just started losing friends. They just kind of disappear. And then what was a trickle became a torrent and then a flood. And it really destroyed our community in a lot of ways. But we also rebuilt ourselves out of it, right? And the arc of the disease has just been a phenomenal experience for both the city and for the gay community, right?
As this anniversary date, June the 5th, that Sunday 30 years ago when the first reports came out, as this anniversary approaches, does it take you back to that time? When you see the pink ribbon up on Twin Peaks these days, do you think back on that time and the people that were lost?
Yeah, it's very painful. I see faces. I see faces of people I came out with. I see faces of people I lost during the 90s. I see faces. I lost a couple of people this year. You know, we're still losing people. And I think that's what kind of gets lost in a lot of this is that there's still a drip, drip, drip of people dying from really odd things that, frankly, are HIV related and are making their lives shorter. And everybody has this treatment optimism belief that the pills are great and they'll keep you alive. You know, with a normal lifespan, but that's simply not true. HIV, perhaps some side effects of the medications, both of them somehow are shortening our lifespans. And people are dying from non-HIV-related cancer, heart attacks. So things are still tough for people with HIV. And one of the things we need to start talking about is a cure. And that's one of the most exciting things that's happened this year, is that we actually have a patient who's been cured of HIV 4 years ago, 4 years now.
We'll get into those hopes and the choices, really, that are before us in terms of where AIDS research and treatment should focus over the course of this hour. Jeff Sheehy, again, an HIV patient advocate and board member of the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine, which is funding some of the research that Jeff just spoke of. What's changed for you, Grant Colfax, over these years? You're so engaged with the effort to prevent the spread of AIDS at the San Francisco Department of Public Health. What's evolved for you?
Well, I think looking back that we've learned so much. And the question is, can we make the next 30 years, the last 30 years of new HIV infections? And it is within our grasp now to eliminate new HIV infections in San Francisco.
There's some pretty remarkable statistics. Walk us through some of those involving the way in which the rate, not only the rate of infection, but the fact that there hasn't been a baby born in San Francisco for a number of years.
So if we look at the perinatal transmission, one of the great results that has occurred in the last 5 years is we haven't had any perinatal transmission. So no babies have been born with HIV in San Francisco. And the reason for this is really around testing and treatment, that there's universal offer of testing to pregnant women, HIV testing to pregnant women, and then women who are found to be HIV infected are offered treatment because of a comprehensive approach to perinatal health. We've been able to have this remarkable outcome. The question is now, as we move forward in thinking about the next 30 years, we think of prevention, care, treatment, and cure. Those are sort of the four areas that we believe are important to concentrate on, with better testing technologies, so we can now detect HIV much sooner in the course of disease than we've been able to before. With better treatments, it's clear now that the virus is worse than the treatments. So we're recommending from the health department that everybody be offered treatment once an HIV diagnosis is made. It doesn't only benefit the individual, but now it's very clear from studies that have just recently emerged that treatment also reduces the risk of transmission. So testing, treatment in a broader context of a holistic approach to HIV prevention and care and treatment. We know a pill is not a magic bullet. We know that behavioral strategies are still critical components, and we know that we can only succeed through very strong collaborations with community health departments and scientists.
I want to dig into that question of how treatment is affecting not only individuals, but how it's stopping the spread of the disease in a moment with Dr. Deeks. But before we get into that, Stephen LeBlanc, just a thought from you as on this 30th anniversary. Are you left feeling optimistic about where we go from her, or as Jeff Sheehy was suggesting, also reminded of how far we still have to go?
I think I'm feeling optimistic, and I guess when I reflect back, I see that within the AIDS epidemic, there's been a lot of sort of turning points that were times of confusion and sort of cusps as we switched from one stage of the epidemic to the other. And looking back, I'm remembering how uncertain we were at those turning points. And when I first got tested, it was like 1982, 83. And even at the time, I was counseled, and they said, well, how will you feel if your results are positive? And I said, well, that might mean that I have immunity and I've been exposed, because that's what we sort of thought might be true in 82, 83. And then we found out that, no, if you were positive, that was more or less a death sentence for most people. And that was kind of a real dark turning point. And I was very active here in 95, and people were slightly excited about new therapies, but nobody predicted in 1995 that by 1996 we would be declaring that AIDS was a chronic manageable disease. I mean, within that 12-month period, everything changed.
How long have you lived with the disease?
Right around 1995 is when I found out I was positive. And I just want to say right now, I hope that we're at another cusp, and we seem to be, where you know, 3 years ago, nobody was predicting the end of the AIDS epidemic through any of these, you know, through prevention, through treatment as prevention, or through a cure. And I do, you know, I'm seeing some of the cure technology and therapies that are incredibly exciting. And I think there's a possibility that much more quickly than anybody thinks that a cure could be available, you know, even in 3 to 5 years.
And just in personal terms, going back to 95, was it imaginable to you that you could be sitting here participating in this talk show 16 years later?
In 1995, my doctor told me I had 4 years to live.
Yeah. Glad you're here this morning. Stephen LeBlanc is a board member for the AIDS Policy Project. Stephen Deeks joins us as well. He's a professor of medicine at UCSF. As we talk about these turning points that have happened over the past 30 years, we seem to be at one of those now. Walk us through some of what's been found, some of these recent stories just over this past month, about what we're learning with aggressive treatment of individuals as soon as they're diagnosed, not only what that does for them, but what we're learning about how that seems to stop the spread of the disease itself.
Sure. Let me just offer a little bit on the history of how we got here. So in 1996, right, this was truly a turning point, right? This is when these drugs first became available.
These are the so-called AIDS cocktails.
The cocktails,
antiretroviral
drugs. Three drugs, right? Triple drug therapy. We should go back and remember that point in the history of medicine, because it's I don't think it's something like that ever happened before. Essentially, you took a whole population of people with a fatal disease. And not quite overnight, but pretty quickly, people got better. And there were people in hospices in San Francisco who in 1996 walked home. This occurred because we at that time had constructed the capacity to build these regimens of three drugs that were pretty toxic at the time, but clearly saved lives. And what we've done since then, and I would go from 1996 to about a year ago, the entire effort from a therapeutic perspective has been focused on making those drugs better. And we are now at a point where I would say that if you are an HIV-infected person and you have access to healthcare and you are motivated, okay, so you have to have access and be motivated, you can construct a regimen which is reasonably safe, well-tolerated, and will probably keep the virus under control for the rest of your life.
And not only will it keep your disease under control, it will do what in terms of stopping the spread of the disease?
In a study which Grant knows better than I, and he can comment on it, recently there was a randomized study of discordant couples.
Meaning?
One partner was positive and one partner was negative. And the positive partner received therapy. And it was a randomized study, so half the couples had therapy to the positive partner and half did not. And I think there was one transmission in the – and it was a very large study. Grant, help me. What was the –
one transmission in the arm where the treatment was delayed, so people did not receive treatment. And there were 27, I believe, infections in the arm that were – I'm sorry. There were 27 right. infections in the arm where treatment was delayed, and there was only one infection in the arm where treatment was provided. So there was a 6% risk reduction. So it dramatically showed that the bottom line is it dramatically showed that treatment dramatically reduces HIV transmission.
So can we say at this point that given the caveats that Dr. Deeks included, that if you have access to care, and in other words, if you have also the money for care or insurance that covers care, and you're motivated to participate in that care, that the spread of AIDS can be stopped?
Well, I think there's one other important caveat in this study and other studies that are done, which is that everybody in those studies receives risk reduction counseling and instructions on how important condom use is. So this was on top of very important counseling messages and encouragement to use condoms. So condoms still remain a mainstay of HIV prevention strategies. Treatment clearly is an augmentation of it enhances the prevention effect. So when we think about treatment, we also need to think about continuing risk reduction messages and encouraging people to use condoms and clean needles. But clearly, treatment now becomes a mainstay of a prevention strategy. We've really seen in the last 5 years, especially, a marriage, if you will, of prevention and treatment. Traditionally, treatment is focused on the individual benefit. Prevention is focused on community benefit. These distinctions are no longer valid. What really resonates is a continuum of a comprehensive approach of treatment, both benefiting the individual as well as the community.
Dr. Grant Colfax, he's director of the HIV Prevention and Research Department of the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Does that mean, Dr. Deeks, in some ways then, that the search for a vaccine, which has always been hoped for and never achieved, is in some ways accomplished by treatment, that treatment in effect achieves the goal of a vaccine?
Treatment would probably make a vaccine irrelevant if treatment could be delivered to everybody in the world and everybody in the world who needed treatment could take it forever.
Yeah.
And those are not – and that's not going to happen, right?
So let's also talk then about that's not a silver bullet in this way. And it gets back to what you said earlier on, Jeff Sheehy, that even if you do have treatment – I mean, it's sort of good news, bad news, right? In a way, it allows people to live with the disease. But can it fool us into thinking that sort of everything is good? Because there are side effects, there are other problems that can come about even if you do receive that sort of treatment.
Well, and Dr. Deeks has really done some incredible research on this. What we've found is that even though you're well controlled in terms of the virus that you can discover in your blood with the antiretrovirals, that there's still activity from the virus in reservoirs in your body that causes inflammation, and that inflammation causes all sorts of damage to your body. One of the reasons that Grant was talking about the change in policy for San Francisco and offering treatment to individuals as soon as they're diagnosed is that damage starts from the moment of infection. And if you have uncontrolled virus, the damage is really pretty severe and can shorten your lifespan, especially if you start treatment late. But even for those like myself who I've been undetectable for a decade, I have a much higher risk of heart disease from the inflammation. They say for a person who's 50, my immune system looks like that of a person who's 85. And one of the reasons that people who are in their 80s have much higher rates of cancer is that their immune system isn't able to clean up the cancers that are happening in our body. The tumor cells happen every day in our body.
So this brings us to the question of sort of where we need to go from here and what we need to focus on. There's such good news in terms of what treatment can do, both for individuals, those who suggest there's still many problems remaining for people who live with HIV, such good news about what that can mean to stop the spread of the disease. But does it also mean, Stephen LeBlanc, that we're taking our eyes off the prize as far as focusing on a cure? Or do you have a concern as an activist in this area that we're not spending enough, focusing enough on cure as opposed to prevention and treatment?
Well, I think as of right now, it's clear that we're not focusing enough on cure research. I mean, and that's been sort of why the AIDS Policy Project reactivated a year and a half ago. At the time, even a year and a half ago, there was even very little attention or talk about cure research. That has changed, thankfully, and now it seems like everybody's talking about it. But we still have a tiny, tiny fraction of the amount of AIDS research dollars that are spent are actually spent on cure research. And that's something that, you know, some activists in San Francisco and Philadelphia and New York are taking a lead in trying to change. Because, you know, we spend in the U.S. about $24 billion a year on AIDS. We spend probably less than $100 million on all forms of research directed towards finding a cure.
Stephen LeBlanc, again, a board member of the AIDS Policy Project. Well, what do we know about the prospects for a cure? Dr. Stephen Deeks at UCSF, maybe tell us a little bit about the story that got a fair amount of attention a couple of years ago, the case of Timothy Brown, someone who was cured, if we can use that word. What happened with Timothy Brown? Does that bode well for the prospects of coming up with something that could be used in a more widespread fashion?
So Timothy was a gentleman was doing quite well, HIV infected. On therapy and developed a form of leukemia that was quite aggressive and required a bone marrow transplant. and a very clever team of clinicians in Berlin or in Germany basically decided at that time to perform the transplant with the immune system from a person who was naturally resistant to HIV.
And that's because there are certain people who have a genetic mutation that basically prevents them from ever getting HIV?
1 in 100 Northern Europeans, about, lack something called CCR5 in their immune system. And CCR5 is basically the door by which HIV enters into its target T cell. So if you are one of those people, you live a normal, healthy lifestyle, a life without your CCR5 in your immune system. If you're one of those people, it's basically very difficult for that person to become HIV infected. So the transplant took the bone marrow from someone who had that CCR5 deletion, and it was transplanted into Timothy. And as is common during the post-transplant period, when Timothy was quite sick, he had to stop his antiretroviral drugs. It happens all the time that people undergoing transplants because they're so sick from the transplant, and the virus didn't rebound. And after a rocky course, I mean, he was in and out of the hospital for a couple years with transplant-related problems. You know, he's now doing quite well in terms of his leukemia and in terms of his HIV. And he basically stopped his medications. I think it's been about 4 or 5 years now. And no one has been able to detect any evidence that the virus still exists.
So accurate to say that he, Timothy Brown, has been cured of AIDS?
I think a growing consensus is that it depends on how you define cure. If we can define cure, as many might want to define it, as basically being essentially virus-free 5 years after stopping therapy, which is kind of the cancer model, right? If you're cancer-free for 5 years, you're cured. Then I would say that Timothy basically more or less is now meeting that definition.
We're coming up on a break in just a moment, but outline briefly for us, as and then we'll pursue this after the break, what the possibilities are for taking something like that and coming up with a cure therapy that could be more widely applied, because obviously there are some difficulties in doing a transplant for every person who has the virus.
It's essentially the kind of his cure is the kind of cure you'd rather have the disease, right? So no one is going to do this again unless someone has leukemia. I mean, he truly suffered. It was a very courageous thing that he did, and he's been very courageous in talking about it and has inspired people. But I don't think that bone marrow transplant per se really is a way to go for cure. Now, there are other ways to do this, and there's a company actually in the Bay Area, Sangamo, who has developed this capacity to use sort of a molecular scissors to surgically remove CCR5 from an immune system. And it's possible that we can, in the future, take immune cells from an HIV-infected person, do this gene therapy, remove the CCR5, put it back in, and essentially repeat what had done with Timothy. And that would be much safer. And people are pursuing that pretty aggressively these days.
Dr. Stephen Deeks, professor of medicine at UCSF. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about where we need to go from here, whether or not we're putting enough money into the research efforts that would lead to a cure, and also what still needs to be done in terms of treatment and prevention to stop the spread of AIDS, now 30 years into the AIDS story. Here's the number if you want to join our conversation or pose a question to one of our guests. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. If you're someone who has lived with this disease, what are your hopes for the future? We'd like to hear from you. Where do you think dollars ought to be spent as we go forward? Join us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments there. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the 30th anniversary of the discovery of what became known as AIDS, where we've gone over these past 30 years and where we still have to go. Our guests include Dr. Stephen Deeks. He's a professor of medicine at UCSF. Stephen LeBlanc, he is a board member of the AIDS Policy Project. Jeff Sheehy, board member of the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine. And Dr. Grant Colfax, the director of the HIV Prevention and Research Division of the San Francisco Department of Public Health. And we welcome your calls and thoughts on this topic. If you're someone who has lived with AIDS, what your thoughts are on this 30th anniversary, where you'd like to see the focus of treatment and research to go in the future, 866-733-6786 is the number, 866-733-6786. Or you can join us by email, forum@kqed.org, forum@kqed.org. We haven't talked much yet about the question of access to care and the disparities in who is continuing to struggle with this condition the most. As you work on this topic, Grant Colfax, at the HIV Prevention and Research Division of the Public Health Department here in the city, what worries you the most about where we're still not making headway?
Well, the focus in San Francisco, the epidemic is concentrated among gay men, and that's always been the case. 90% of our new HIV infections and 90% of our previous infections have been among gay men. Within that context, there are disparities, particularly among African-American gay men. The rate of HIV infection is at least twice as high among African-American gay men compared to other gay men in San Francisco.
And do we know why that's the case? Is it a question of access to care? Is it a question of people being more reluctant to get screening? What's going on with making that statistic?
That's a really good question, and the puzzle has not been solved there. When we look at the data, actually, African-American gay men are as likely or even more likely to get HIV, to report being HIV tested. There are questions about access to care. We do find that African-American gay men tend to present for care later in the course of disease. So this really brings up the question of access to care in general and how we improve access to care in San Francisco and nationally, as well as obviously internationally, so that people can get treated for the disease. In San Francisco, again, we've made it a policy to offer everybody treatment as soon as they're diagnosed. The question is now, what kind of support are we able to give people so that they can actually get the health care that they need?
What else do you think needs to be done, Stephen LeBlanc, as someone who's worked as an activist in this area for a couple of decades now, to get the word out better among those populations, whether that's African Americans or others, who aren't necessarily don't have either the access to care or for whatever reason, choosing not to be involved in care?
That's a very huge – there's a lot of issues there. A lot of people, especially in both Pacific Island Asian communities and African-American communities, are not out within their family context. And so – and if they're living in a close family group, which is more likely in those communities, it's scary for them to get the drugs, have the drugs, take the drugs. And that's one reason that, you know, I know of for delays. Something that I also think, you know, Dr. Deeks mentioned that you have to be motivated. I think that minimizes the problem, which is you have to have the kind of life where you've got the organization that, you know, every month you get a hold somehow of these $2,000 worth of drugs per month that you can take every single day, you know, on a regular basis and keep track of, you know, and people who are having other challenges in their life, people who are homeless, people who may be struggling with, you know, drug addiction or poverty or whatever, you know, it just simply having that kind of organization and being able to, you know, either, you know, do the paperwork, get to the pharmacy, make sure the drugs are on hand, make sure they've met with their doctor, can be a huge challenge and a huge barrier to effective care. The only alternative for that is something like a cure, and that's why that's what we're pushing for.
And I think that the stigma and the discrimination that
Dr. Colvex,
the stigma and discrimination, we cannot underestimate the stigma and discrimination that still continues with HIV. I've had patients tell me who know they're HIV infected that they do not want to come to a clinic that's known for its HIV care.
So have we not traveled as far as we like to think we've traveled, Jeff Sheehy, on that front? Is the amount of discrimination, the amount of stigmatization that Dr. Colfax referenced still much more prevalent than perhaps most of us would like to think, especially here in San Francisco?
Well, maybe not as much here in San Francisco, but absolutely. I mean, we have the tools right now to break the back of this epidemic in this country. Yet there are 8,000 people in this country who are indicated for drugs, who are motivated to take them, who are waiting to get them.
They're on wait lists because of there's not enough support.
There's not enough funding for the drugs. And so why with this infectious disease have we not summoned the national will to do the kinds of treatment and prevention interventions across this country that we need to do to stop this epidemic? Is because we don't care about the people who are getting the disease.
On the other hand,
why don't we have needle exchanges? Yeah. That's why we don't have a heterosexual epidemic in San Francisco, because we have needle exchanges going on, 15, 20 years now. That's one of the major ways that HIV gets into the heterosexual community, is through just sharing of dirty needles among people who are using drugs.
On the other hand, wouldn't it be also fair to say that an enormous amount of resources have been focused on this over the last 30 years? As Dr. Deeks was saying earlier, the fact that in the mid-90s there was this ability to come up with these drugs to essentially change a disease that was a death sentence to something that was not indicates a fair amount of resources have been marshaled. True?
True. But again, we have the means to stop an epidemic. I mean, you either can or you can't. You either do or you don't.
Let's hear what our listeners want to weigh in on this topic, and then we'll pursue this subject more. Ron in Marin joins us first. Ron, go ahead, please.
Hi. Actually, I've been working since 1985 with Hope and Beyond, a student service and learning project. And in that, we recognize that students react to social pressures and stigmas. And with the Department of Health's announcement, the U.S. Department of Health's announced that 25% of people infected do not know they're infected, and what stigma. Nationally, what real campaigns are there to overcome the fears and stigmas which are at the core of those who resist being tested?
Ron, thanks. Thanks for that observation. Dr. Colfax, you want to respond?
Well, there are a number of campaigns that the CDC has recently launched specifically around addressing stigma and discrimination. And one of the major policy changes that has happened is it's now recommended that everybody get a routine HIV test with their healthcare provider. And that's a shift. And although that might sound like an obvious thing that needs to be done, the goal of this is really breaking down the stigma of around getting HIV tested so that it's a routine part of your healthcare, that it's a routine part of your life. So getting an HIV test, as we heard earlier in the program in the early 80s, and when I received my first HIV test, it was a really big deal, and there was a lot of anxiety and a lot of preparation and post-reaction to it. And I think now what we're trying to do is make HIV testing a routine part of people's lives. The earlier people get HIV tested in their adolescence, we think that the better people will do in terms of making it a routine part of their testing. A Greater Than AIDS campaign has been launched by CDC and others, which is really about empowering the community and decreasing the stigma and discrimination, particularly in the African American community. So I think that all these efforts are trying to make HIV a less scary, less stigmatized disease, while acknowledging, of course, what Jeff was saying, that it is an infectious disease, and we do have the tools within our grasp to tackle it effectively. I just want to say that in terms of the resources, 3% of the HIV/AIDS budget federally is allocated to prevention. So if we want to get serious about how to really tackle this disease, I think we need to think about that 3%. And you can't do that much with 3% allocation in terms of really ending the disease. We have the knowledge. We know what to do. The question is now, do we have the political will and the community to support to do it?
Dr. Grant Colfax, who heads up the HIV Prevention and Research Division of the Department of Health in San Francisco. We've heard that phrase a couple of times, Dr. Deeks. Jeff said it, and Grant as well, Colfax, about that we have the tools to break the disease. Would you say that also from a research point of view, that we have the tools? Do you have what you need?
Combination antiretroviral therapy could, if administered worldwide to everybody who needs it, break the epidemic. So in theory we have the tools, but right, we need the resources. Right, someone has to pay for it. Not only for people in the United States, but globally, and people need to take it every day and for years and years. And that's, you know, I think if. You know, when I first got into this business, this whole concept that, you know, I would give a patient a pill and it would save his life, I would think that person every day would get up and have no problem taking that pill. But you do that day in, day out for years, it wears you out psychologically. And if there's the smallest side effect, right, that side effect basically can, it just sort of grows as a major part of your life over time.
And also even on that treatment, you do, as Jeff Sheehy, as I understand it, and please comment on this, mm-hmm. you still have a compromised immune system. Is that correct? You have the immune system of someone who is older. You're subject to more prone to possibilities of heart disease and so forth.
Okay. So that's indeed true. But so there are two things being compared here, right? If you compare treated disease to untreated disease, right, there's no question. Treatment is much better for you than the virus. And I believe it's much better for you than the virus from day one. And that if you want to maintain your health, you should get on therapy as soon as possible. And to a certain degree, we now expect more than simply just, you know, making untreated disease better. We are now asking the question, can we restore health to the same that you get in someone's HIV negative? And the answer to that, particularly among people who delay therapy, is no. We are making people much, much better, but we are not restoring health. And the complications that we're seeing are heart disease, bone disease, kidney disease, neurologic disease, diseases that we typically associate with the concept of aging. And so that's led to this sort of growing concern or consensus that the aging process is perhaps a bit accelerated in people with HIV. And this is a major potential limitation.
Which brings us back to this question of focusing more on the question of a cure, some mm-hmm. of the possibilities for which you outlined right before our break. Do you think we're just not paying enough attention to that, Jeff Sheehy? Are you thinking about that more now at the Center for Regenerative Medicine, of which you sit on the board? Is that something that we need to think about more than we currently are?
Well, what's happening in biomedical research is a whole new range of technologies are being brought to bear across an entire range of diseases. And certainly regenerative medicine, stem cell research, is a major piece of that. And what surprised me when I got appointed to this board, I really didn't think there was very much in HIV that could be done. We had the example of the Berlin patient, Timothy Brown, and we had a really highly rated application come through. But then there are people in the room who said, don't fund it. They got the pills. They're fine. And I got up in the middle of that review and I said, look, I'm on the pills and it's no picnic, let me tell you. And we need to bring these technologies to bear for HIV. And that was, what, 3-4 years ago. And so we're funding. One of the projects was the one that Steve described. We put $15 million into a project with Sangamo and the City of Hope to try to genetically engineer a person's own immune system to resist HIV. But we were pretty lonely there for a while. And, you know, you had people like Tony Fauci getting out there and saying, well, this is just not practical to even talk
from
about.
From the NIH.
From the NIH, the head of the funding for all the AIDS programs at the NIH. And so it's been a little lonely, but thank God for the voters in 2004 who got us started with Prop 71 and the far side of Californians. But and thanks to Stephen and Katie Krause with the AIDS Policy Project for really getting people to start to focus on thinking about a cure, because the pills are not the end.
Jeff Sheehy, he is a board member of the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine, HIV patient advocate. We welcome your thoughts on this topic as we approach the 30th anniversary of when AIDS first came into the American life. 866-733-6786 is the number, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or join us online on our website, kqed.org/forum. Comment from our website that came in from David, who writes, I've been infected for over 22 years, and thank God I'm still here. The term cocktail seems to me an insidious one promoted by the drug manufacturers that nullifies the serious nature of this disease and unsafe practices. Why do I still hear this term in use when in the common dialogue? Do you think that's a problem, Dr. Colfax, that we refer to it as the cocktail?
I would agree with the email that it does have it does make it seem more exciting than it actually is, and certainly less toxic. Again, the complications of living with HIV are, as Steve and Jeff have talked about extensively, are serious. And I think that the point is now is that in the last 5 years, it's become clear that the virus is worse than the drug. So whether you call the drug a cocktail or not, the point is the access to care issue becomes central. Taking the meds becomes very important for the individual health. So the cocktail term may be insidious. It has been pretty widely used in the community. We're down to, for many people, one pill a day. So I think that what we've seen is that people who – there's still a number of people who have – very strong belief systems against taking the drugs. And I think that that's one of the pieces in terms of education that we really need to work on in terms of educating people that this is really – obviously people should make an informed decision about whether to take the drugs or not. But the benefit to the individual is now very clear.
Let's explore something else that we haven't touched on yet that also perhaps has to do with the question of resistance. A number of stories in the past couple of years, maybe you can start us out on this, Stephen LeBlanc, about younger people, younger gay men, sort of not taking the disease as seriously, perhaps because they didn't live through what you and others lived through in the 80s and 90s, perhaps because the treatment possibilities make the disease somehow less scary than it once was. How big a concern is that of yours as someone who works on these issues, that young people in particular may not be taking this as seriously as they ought?
I think it's a concern and a little bit of a tragedy. I mean, I meet 20-year-olds who are HIV infected, you know, every time I talk publicly about the disease. And again, it's one of the ways that I think the sort of treatment everyday model falls short and why we're pushing for a cure. Because as long as the model is treatment everyday, and as long people are going to stay out of that model, they're either not going to get tested, they're not going to take the drugs. And what we know is that they remain infected or infectious. And, you know, if you go out into the gay community today, especially the younger gay community, you don't see people who look sick. So the idea that there is a deadly disease out there is not as in the faces of young people. You know, I was commenting when I was talking to your assistant about this program, you know, if you look at popular young gay culture today, TV shows like Glee, for example, I don't think AIDS has ever been mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not sort of in the consciousness of a lot of 20-year-olds. And yet there are many 20-year-olds who are infected. There are many 20-year-olds who are infected and don't know they're infected. And so, therefore, are able to infect others. And that certainly still is happening. And I meet those people every day. And it's tragic.
And back to our calls. Ray in Daly City joins us next. Ray, go ahead, please.
Yes, my name is Ray. And I've been affected with HIV since 1998. I've been taking a drug since then called Atripla. And I'm just curious as to how that's going to affect my long-term life. I'm now 59.
Ray, thank you. Dr. Deeks, can you respond to that particular drug, Atripla?
That's the most popular drug out there today. It's very popular because it's highly effective, and it's given as a one pill. It's three drugs in one pill, and it's given once a day. You know, it's not completely benign. There are some long-term side effects, perhaps affecting bone and kidney. Again, the side effects are not nearly as harmful for you as the effect of the virus, so it's better to be on these drugs than allow the virus to replicate. To a certain degree, you know, the question becomes, so what is someone's overall prognosis when people go on a drug like a Atripla and these other combinations? And it's decades, right? It's just not – I mean, people are not going to live to the age of 85 – they may live into their, you know, late 60s, 70s if they acquire HIV early in their adulthood. And so it's we're like 80% there, right? We've given people a big chunk of their health back. We haven't completely given it back. And it depends how healthy people are on therapy, I think, depends less on the combination, because most of the combinations out there are reasonably safe. It's where you start. It's when you start. And for people who wait to the very end, which is common, people coming in when they are sick and they have put this decision off as long as possible, even though we can get the virus under control in those people, those are the individuals who will have residual long-term complications to deal with.
Dr. Stephen Dix. Ray, thanks very much for the call. Email from James. Back in 2001, I remember seeing volunteer requests for an HIV-related vaccination study being conducted through the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda. Could one of your guests comment on the current progress of vaccination solutions? Dr. Dix?
There have been many high-profile failures and a few potential successes over the past several years. There was a vaccine that was actually generated a fair amount of enthusiasm in the community and among scientists. It turned out that that vaccine actually increased the risk in a subset of individuals to acquire HIV. And so that was actually not a good outcome. And that approach is being reconsidered, obviously.
Should it still be the focus of much research and much dollars? I mean, if you were in the position of Dr. Anthony Fauci at NIH, would you put more money into the search for a vaccine, or is that a sort of a fool's errand?
Oh, no. I think the likelihood of a vaccine that will actually turn the tide of the epidemic is probably better, higher than a cure. But I think both are possible, and both could fundamentally change things. And so resources in either direction need to be maintained.
And I just add that there are a number of vaccine trials that are ongoing, including in San Francisco. Dr. Susan Buchbinder has been a leader in this, and through the health department and through UCSF, they're still looking for volunteers for these very important studies.
Question about cost. How much does the AIDS cocktail, there's that word again, cost per year, and what is the typical coverage provided by insurance? Stephen or Jeff, can one of you comment on both costs and the question of typical insurance?
Well, the retail costs, $25,000 a year is a good number just for the prescription drugs, and that's not including other associated medical care. I think coverage I can't speak to that well. I have private insurance, with a almost $3,000 deductible. But, that is one of the huge issues. And we know for sure that, 8,000 people in the U.S. right now can't access the drugs just because of the cost.
And does this vary, I assume, Dr. Colfax, city to city, state to state? I mean, the policy in San Francisco allows anyone who needs to get on this treatment to get on it?
Yes. So we've committed to offering treatment and providing treatment to people. It does vary tremendously by city to city, state by state. I think in the larger context, one of the big changes has been in the last year is we now have a national HIV/AIDS strategy, which has three goals, which is to decrease incidence, increase access to care, and decrease disparities. So there's hope with healthcare reform that we will be seeing broader and better coverage and allow people who would otherwise come in late in the course of the disease to access ART. That puzzle has not been solved, and there's tremendous concern in the activists and other communities that this vision will not be recognized. So I think we all need to work together to figure out how does healthcare reform, how do we take advantage of this moment to ensure better access to medications?
And again, to state the obvious, the question of access is so key because of what we now know about being treated early, both for the individual and to stop the spread of the condition. Another email coming in. The HIV epidemic among drug users has particular challenges. Can any of you perhaps address this? Where are we at with that, Dr. Colfax, in San Francisco, among drug users?
So as Jeff was saying earlier, thanks to the community activism in the early 90s, San Francisco was the first city out in the country to have an aggressive needle exchange program. We know that a proven HIV prevention strategy is needle exchange. Another big advance in the last year has been the federal ban on needle exchange was actually lifted. So we're now actually able to use federal dollars for clean needle programs. So we have an aggressive needle exchange program in our city, and other urban jurisdictions are now able to ramp those up. One of the pieces of the epidemic that is emerging is that it's not just about injection drug use. It's also about other drug use. So we talked about youth in particular. Youth using drugs, particularly methamphetamines, cocaine, other stimulants, there's a clear association between increased risk behavior and increased risk of HIV transmission. So really thinking about drug treatment in addition to needle exchanges, an HIV prevention strategy is a critical component of what we do.
We just have a moment or two left, so last couple of quick thoughts. Jeff Sheehy first on where what you'd like people like us to think about on this 30th anniversary.
I'd like us to think about having some of the energy that we had in the mid-90s when things looked really bleak, when that turning point that Steve and Stephen talked about from 95 to 96, when the sun suddenly came up again, to kind of bring that to bear at least for a couple of years on a couple of key points, making sure at least everybody in this country gets access to care. Because that will increase testing. If people have health insurance, they're less scared to go in and get tested because they know they get access to these medications that will save their lives. So, you know, we have a president. We have a national HIV/AIDS policy. We have a health reform. We should turn that into really breaking the back of this epidemic in this country. And then we need to start talking about a cure. You know, hope is always important. As our president, again referencing Barack Obama, talked about 4 years ago, we got to have this hope, and it's a reasonable hope. And using all these new technologies in biomedicine, developing them, and then making sure people have access to them can really transform medicine in this country. So that's what I'd like us to see, some renewed energy.
Mm-hmm. It's a good point on which to conclude our program. I want to thank Jeff Sheehy, who we just heard from, HIV patient advocate and board member of California Institute of Regenerative Medicine. Jeff, thanks for being with us today. Steve Deeks joins us as well, professor of medicine at UCSF. Dr. Deeks, thank you as well. Stephen LeBlanc, board member of the AIDS Policy Project, and Dr. Grant Colfax, the director of the HIV Prevention and Research Division of the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Thanks, all of you, for participating in our program. Thanks, too, to our producers, Kevin Guillory, Tina Lorberg, and Amy Machado. Thanks to our engineer, Danny Bringer, and our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.